James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, broadcasting live from beautiful Trout Lake, Washington, otherwise known as UFO and Paranormal Central. We've got a great guest tonight. We have the author Lynn McTaggart, the author of The Intention Experiment and The Field, both books which I have an extreme interest in, the effects of consciousness and its effects on reality, the reality that we live in. So before going too much further into this, I want to welcome Lynn McTaggart on the line. Are you here with us, Lynn?
Hi there. How you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Now, you're over in England right now. Is that correct?
I am. I live in London.
Is it getting a little chilly over there with the changes going on?
Well, it's just rainy. We have terrible, terrible weather. We've had some bad flooding.
Mm-hmm.
It's very bizarre weather.
Yeah, we're having the same thing here. We've got about almost up to 5 feet of snow on the ground, and we have a tunnel now for a driveway.
Oh, wow.
About 2 foot over you know, a bad winter. So it's,
oh, really?
It's pretty insane right now. We've got about a 12-foot drift on the side of our conference building. You know. So.
Oh, my goodness. Everybody's having very extreme weather.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the work that you've been doing with the intention experiments, now that can definitely affect the weather. Is this correct?
Well, this is what we're testing. I mean, the interesting thing about this project and this book is that it's a living book. Mm-hmm. In the sense that I'm using my readers to help me finish it. I was very interested in the power of intention and the science of intention, but I was also interested in power of group mind,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not lots of people thinking the same thought at the same time can magnify the effect and actually be powerful enough to change a lot of the catalog of suffering and problems we have on the planet. So I set up with a number of scientists around the world a series of experiments that are ongoing where periodically I ask my readers to come online and send an intention to a particular target. And that target will be sitting in one of these labs. Most recently we've been using University of Arizona, Gary Schwartz in University of Arizona, also Konstantin Korotkov, Russian physicist at St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg State Technology College. And they both have laboratories, and we've been sending intention to affect all kinds of targets. And all of them have ecological implications. We're looking at a lot of things about lowering temperature, making plants grow more abundantly, biofuels, all kinds of things like that. And we've had some extraordinary results.
Yeah, I know they've done a lot of experiments in the past where they would take seeds and put three batches in. The middle would be the control, and one they would just curse and swear at, and the other one they'd send loving thoughts to, and there is a definite effect there. The ones with the loving, joyous thoughts that were projected to them seemed to grow abundantly, and they had a very high germination rate, and the ones that the people just, you know, sent all kinds of negative energy to had entirely opposite effects.
Well, this is exactly what's happened with us, too. We found the same effects when we've done similar experiments. We had a series of germination experiments where we had one set of target seeds and three sets of controls. And our scientists at the University of Arizona didn't know which seeds we were sending intention to. I'd let my readers pick somebody randomly pick a set batch of seeds. We'd all send intention to those seeds for 10 minutes to grow at a certain rate by a certain day. And we found, doing this study four different times with four different audiences, that the seeds grew significantly faster that were sent this positive intention. In fact, in one of those cases, with very experienced intenders, the seeds grew twice as large.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there... go ahead.
So I was just going to say, so the implications on our food supply are just enormous.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I was wondering is there the necessity now, in a lot of these experiments, the people will come in and hold the seeds and be right there with it, but there seems to be this non-locality event going on where you don't really have to be there. You can send it from just about anywhere in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been quite amazing. The studies that we've done, I've carried them out with a group of people in Australia, and we've sent intention to the seed targets in Tucson, Arizona. So that's thousands and thousands of miles away. We've sent them from a small group in Rhinebeck, New York, of 100 people, and we've also sent the intention to, you know, to Arizona, and from South Carolina, and then over the internet, people scattered many, many countries around the globe. Our last experiment, we had people from 80 different countries around the globe participating. And so we found that it doesn't seem to matter. Distance doesn't matter at all. And it also, you don't have to be in the presence of the thing or hold them. You don't even have to have a live image. It can be a photo. We've just used photos of the seeds. And that in enough, itself is good enough. Even more, we did one experiment with algae where I had a picture of some algae in the scientist's lab, not the algae we were sending intention to, and the study still worked. So it's like there's a little beacon. As long as you have something to target the mind to, so it focuses on the target, that seems to be good enough.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen, I did an experiment here. We were doing the Fendhorn gardening here, and we just had amazing crops, just, you know, working with other intelligences and working with the plants and tapping into the energies of the land and finding out what to plant, where to plant. It's kind of amazing how that all works. But I kept meditating and I kept getting something's missing and I kept asking, what is it? And then what I kept getting on an inner level was that what was missing was me sitting in the middle of the garden visualizing the garden growing and everything you know, becoming abundant and, you know, highly charged. And so I did that, and we just had a phenomenal garden. So it seems that what your books are all leading to is that we're like this missing link. We have forgotten our part in the creation process and are kind of running around like chickens with our heads cut off.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very true that before Newton and Newtonian science, we understood our place in the middle of the universe as part of it, as the, you know, as creators, as co-creators. And Newton's science, as brilliant as it was in terms of technological advancement, ripped the heart and soul out of the universe in terms of ripping our, we moved to the sidelines, and we're now with the new science really recovering our rightful place as co-creators. And we're now discovering with this new science that what we thought were strange quantum effects, where the observer affects that being observed, are actually happening in the big sticks and stones world we live in.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've noticed now part of my understanding, I'm coming at it from a different angle. I love quantum physics and metaphysics, but I have a very intense spiritual training background, you might say, and they all come together. But what I've seen, you know, the basics are consciousness as being, you know, the creator of reality. It goes from consciousness to light to energy to mass, and there's a vibrational continuum there. But it seems that we've fallen into what I call reactionary mind, where we're just reacting to what the world is throwing at us versus shifting into what I call creationary mind, where you start creating the world in which you want to experience.
Yes. And we're just learning how to do that, and that's really what my books are all about, is hoping to awaken people to this possibility by demonstrating to them that this is not just the stuff of myth anymore and intuition. This is the stuff of scientific fact.
Mm-hmm.
And also by looking at those, that laboratory evidence and lots of evidence in native cultures, etc., for a blueprint of how to do this and how to recreate this in your life, so that we understand how to use those talents and that extended potential that's our birthright.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever work with Marcel Vogel by any chance?
No, but I certainly know about him and I know about his work. He's done some very interesting stuff.
Yeah, we were kind of one of his guinea pigs for a little while, so a long time ago.
But
he had some instruments that were amazing. He could actually measure the chakra system, each chakra, the energies in each chakra. And I was in his office, and Judy Mingo is his right-hand person, and she was taking this device, And she was moving it up my chakras, and when it hit the crown chakra, it went off the scale. And she's, right away she said, "You've had a near-death experience, haven't you?" And I said, "Yes," you know. And she started talking about, you know, all these things. And he had devices that he could actually send the energetic signature long distance of a healing herb or things like that to a person.
Wow.
And then he, shortly after he died, and his whole lab was pretty much, you know, everything disappeared there. But what's sad about these things is the implications is they have both positive or negative implications. You could put, you know, a poisonous or belladonna or something like that in there and send it to somebody and make them ill from a distance just as well.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, a lot of people, you know, believe that, oh, positive intention is more powerful than negative intention. Well, not true. Not according to the scientific data. And I wish I could say otherwise, but I can't. There's been a number of studies showing that when someone sends negative intention to a target, particularly somebody who is trained in it, like a Qigong master, mm-hmm. who can send destroying mind, he can work just as well as when he's sending positive mind, peaceful mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that ability to affect has a positive or a negative connotation. And certainly we know this just, you know, viscerally. When we walk into a room and we feel bad vibes from somewhere, there's probably some negative intention that's happened around or some negative thought train that is affecting the environment.
And, we
and as we understand this, we'll get better at working at this,
mm-hmm.
and also, you know, dissipating negative intention.
We call those nasty grams, you know. you'll have somebody mad at you, and they start sending you these nasty grams, and all of a sudden you start feeling really uncomfortable. You can even get ill from them.
Yeah, exactly.
They're basically
That's great. That's super.
Yeah, you know, the unified field in which we all exist in, people have no idea how much they're affecting the world around them and the people around them. And, you know, I think about that experiment with the seeds, and then you apply that to somebody's childhood. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a kid that's just been slammed and told, you know, he's worthless, he's this or that, or been yelled at, or, you know, all his life, it's like they've even proven that they physically don't function as well and don't even develop as well.
No, exactly. Exactly. A thought can be, you know, so harmful. A thought that
mm-hmm.
a thought sent, a thought received. So one of the things I talk about a great deal in the intention experiment is being much more mindful of what you're thinking all the time, because we now understand that we're almost like little senders. You know, we're transmitters and receivers at every moment. We're sending out tiny currents of light, which is really tiny currents of information all the time with every thought we have. And we also have evidence that the living things in our environment are picking up this information and replying to it. You know, even things like plants around us. Everything in our environment is picking up and replying at every moment.
Now, they did an experiment, and I believe it was in The Secret Life of Plants. I read it a long time ago, where somebody, I think they were several thousand miles away, and they'd bond with their plants at home, and then they'd put these, I think they're called Bose meters or whatever, that would pick up any responses in the plant, and the person would prick their finger, you know, with a pin and cause pain, and every time the plant would react instantaneously to
absolutely.
To the person.
I mean, all of those studies started with Cleve Baxter, who is I recount his work in my book, The Intention Experiment. Baxter is the country's leading lie detection expert. And this is back in the 60s when he carried out the first study, which was just an accident. He was a little bored one night, and he was sitting there with his cane plant, his Dracaena, and he thought to himself, I wonder if I hooked this plant up to a lie detection equipment, whether the plant would react. And so he did this. And at the time, polygraph tests were just a set of electrodes that you would attach to somebody's fingers. And that would be attached to a readout mechanism that would draw a line with a pen. And if you were telling the truth, it would be a little wavy line. If you were lying, you'd have this giant wavy line. And you can see that in, you know, old B movies.
Mm-hmm.
So Baxter did this, and he then wanted to just see what the plant would do when he added water to it. So he did, and the plant just didn't react. It was almost like the plant was bored. So then he thought, well, I'll have to do something much more drastic. What if I burn its leaf? And it was just that he thought, he didn't burn the leaf, he just thought about doing it. And at the moment he did that, the plant started reacting wildly, and the tracing on the polygraph equipment started going crazy. And he kept thinking that, and he went and got a match, and he lit it, and the plant was going crazy. And as soon as he then decided, no, I'm not going to do that anymore, and he put the match away, the tracing calmed down. And so Baxter, of course, said, what was that? And he thought to himself, my God, that plant has just read my thoughts. And so he has spent now 40 years carrying out all manner of experiments, like you discuss, where an owner has moved 3,000 miles away and had a thought, and the plant reacts. He's hooked up eggs and yogurt and besides plants and bacteria and found that they react to the comings and goings of people and also any disturbances in the environment. Like he had an automated experiment where he inverted a cup he had an automated equipment, and it would invert a cup of brine shrimp into boiling water. His plants were all connected to polygraph equipment, and the moment the brine shrimp would hit the water, the plants would all register alarm, you know, almost like they were, you know, really freaked out by this. So it was, you know, as Baxter put it, it was kind of like Yoda in Star Wars saying, I feel a disturbance in the Force. So, you know, all of these things at the time were considered, you know, heretical because there was no science to explain what was going on. And Baxter was ridiculed. But since that time, there have been a number of studies and discoveries, like those of Fritz Albert Popp and then Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona. Popp is a German physicist at the International Institute for Biophysics, who first came up with the idea that all living things emit a tiny current of light. And he's been able to demonstrate this with very sophisticated equipment, as has Gary Schwartz, who's been able to actually show it on the first kinds of photographs.
Mm-hmm. It seems like every cell has this little pyramid in the center of it that's emitting light. It actually has a bluish field around it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people are seeing the light emitted around each cell. And, you know, I did a thing here, which you'd probably find pretty funny, but there was a woman came up to do an interview with me, and she brought her mobile unit out, you know, to tape the interview, and she had 9 batteries in it, and they were just dead on a doornail, and they had that little thing you push, you know, to see if there's any juice left in them.
Mm-hmm.
And she was pretty upset because I didn't have any D batteries here, and I said, well, just hand them to me, and let's just talk out here for a little while. And so she handed me the batteries, and I charged each one of them just holding them in my hand, and then gave it back to her. And it worked perfectly. And when we're doing the movie Contact Has Begun here, the same thing. The cameraman, he showed up and he had a real exotic camera, and he forgot his charger and it was dead. And he was pretty upset because he couldn't get some of the B-roll and the other things that he needed. And I said, well, give me the battery. And so we were shooting with one of the other cameras for a while, and then I handed it back to him, and it was charged, you know, fully. And it's an exotic. It wasn't like I carried one around in my, you know, pocket, you know.
So, yes.
We have trillions of volts in our system that we don't even know about, and we don't know how to move it or use it, and it could be used for healing or even something as basic as charging batteries.
Wow, yeah. Well, we're just beginning to learn this kind of capability, and it's very exciting to see that a lot of our old assumptions are being overthrown.
You know, you might know in doing your research, This energy that's moving around, I tried to measure it with a voltmeter, and I think it's not sensitive enough, but I couldn't really get much movement on a voltmeter. I think it's a different type of current.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be a different way of measuring this current. Have you run across anything like that?
Not really. It's not what I've looked at. I haven't really looked at things with voltmeters so much. A lot of the polygraph equipment, and which measures the autonomic nervous system, is what I've looked at a lot of. There's a lot of scientific research related to that.
Well, I know the zero point energy, I work with some biophysicists that I can't even talk about, you know, because they worked on certain projects that we don't discuss.
Sure.
It's nice that I had to experience that, but I can't really talk too much about it. But I got to actually experience what they call zero point energy, and it's a whole different animal. It's not like electricity. It actually moves outside the wire, not through
mm-hmm.
the wire. And
mm-hmm.
it has incredible healing properties. And
how exciting.
And so once we bring in that technology, and I really think that's what the same kind of energy our body functions on, because when you run this body through your body, there's amazing healings that come from it.
Well, that would suggest that it is, and certainly there are many people like Fritz Popp and others and Hal Puthoff who believe that really the field is the zero point field is the, you know, alpha and omega of our existence, and that we are constantly carrying out a little, you know, the little subatomic particles of our being are carrying out a little subatomic dance and trading energy all the time with the field.
Uh-huh. Well, it'd be interesting to utilize that field in these experiments. But the what I see also too is that we have, you know, zero point is in our consciousness, you might say. We can, you know, create the same effect just by transmitting our consciousness to people or plants or animals or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. I mean, I think that, you know, we have this ability to tap into the field, and we are just learning how.
Yeah, it is interesting that, you know, I was talking to a couple of the Michio Kaku was one. I was sending him some emails, and we had some conversations going back and forth. And he was saying that there is no way we can't generate enough Planck energy to experience, you know, other dimensions. And
mm-hmm.
basically it's impossible. And I talked to another physicist before, which is one of the guys in What the Bleep. I talked to him a long time ago. The guy from India, what's his name? I'm trying to think of his name.
Amit Goswami.
Yes, yes. Way before What the Bleep, I went and I was talking to him, and he was saying that, you know, you couldn't experience the other fields. The between them, it's too vast. At first, he was saying that. I think he's changed now.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him, I said, well, you know, I have photographs of other dimensional beings standing, you know, right in front of me. And
mm-hmm.
In ships, you know, jumping dimensions, coming into this dimension, you know, orbs, light spheres, all of these things. I work a lot with Michal Ledwith as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and I said, you know, it does. I said, I really believe we have the full use of creational energies, you know, that set the Big Bang into motion
mm-hmm.
within our own bodies, and that and it's our own consciousness, and that we can, you know, bilocate, jump dimensions. We can do all this once we just learn how this works.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, I think to say never is a mistake now, given the discoveries that we're finding now in quantum physics, and that understanding, for instance, just time. You know, there's so many studies showing that are really good positive studies on retrointention, showing that we can send an intention to affect something that supposedly has already happened. Now, that just throws our understanding of time, space, and the whole thing into a cocked hat, basically. You know, it just demonstrates it's up for grabs. And so there's plenty of evidence about parallel universes, and there's plenty of evidence about different dimensions. And certainly some of the scientists that I recount in my book, like William Tiller, shows that intention seems to help one access a different dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be really open-minded here, like all good explorers. You just keep an open mind, and you travel without a compass, and you come up with, you see what you bump into, basically.
Yeah, you know, I agree 100%. It's, you know, because some of the experiences I've had, I wouldn't even talk about them, let alone, you know, because everybody would think I was nuts. But I just have an open mind. I just say, well, that was interesting, you know, and I just stay as an observer and don't get attached to it. And,
yes, exactly. And just say, wow, you know, I will, you know, I'll explore more because we are, you know, there are so many things. You know, you say, oh, this is impossible, one says. And then you look at people who are, say, masters of intention, like Buddhist monks.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, there's one wonderful experiment with them, with Harvard's Herbert Benson, who had wired up these monks who were sitting in a freezing monastery in just their loincloths, and he would periodically wrap them up in freezing wet sheets. And now most of us who had that situation in 40 degree temperatures would go into hypothermia pretty quickly. But what happened with these guys is that they began to sweat because they were able to use their thoughts to raise their body temperature by 20 degrees. In effect, they were turning themselves into a human furnace, and they were able to steam dry those sheets in an hour. So that's, you know, you'd say that, oh, that's impossible. And there are many feats like that for people who know how to really focus the mind that are feats of intention.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I say that, you know, we should be very circumspect about saying that something's impossible, ever.
I was initiated by a Tibetan Lama, and the way I met this guy was interesting. I was in meditation, and he appeared right in front of me. He just, all of a sudden, he just appeared, and I go, who is this guy? And my teeth started bucking way out, like, and I go, this is so strange. I've never seen this. Then a student of mine, I was teaching inner sensitivity classes, said, you know, I'm studying with this Lama, and he wants to meet you. And I said, you know, awesome, I'd love to meet him. So I drove there, and when I meet the guy, he's just laughing, and he's pointing at his teeth, and he has real buck teeth, you know. And so I was, like, merging with him and feeling, you know, that experience. And then this guy, he's in the lineage of the flying Lamas, and I guess they have the ability to bilocate and do all these things, but he would go into meditation, and you could see through him and take a picture, and there'd be Tonkas behind him, and you could see right through him. So when you start seeing things like this on, you know, pretty much a regular basis, you start thinking, you know, this is pretty much an unlimited universe we live in, and the only thing that is limited is our own consciousness.
Yes, 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 absolutely. It's just our belief systems that are limiting. But we're learning that, you know, there's so much good, solid scientific evidence that I recount in my other book, The Field. I've been looking at and I wrote about what's happened since the book was published, and there's a lot of new evidence in there about everything from remote viewing to ESP to retro intention to healing, and all of these things, anything of mind information, of extended sensory information, of mind over matter, all of these things are supposed to be in the realm of the impossible and unprovable, and yet all of them are being demonstrated decisively in the laboratory under very controlled scientific conditions.
You know, I've seen over and over, I mean, I run into this constantly. You know, you have the scientists that's steeped in, you know, the recycled ignorance that they keep teaching as science, and they come after you over and over and over again, and I tell them, I said, you know, the world is only as big as the mind that can perceive it, and if you don't have the neural net, you're not going to have the experience. It's that simple. And and I try to explain to them, you know, you don't see with your eyes. Your brain decides what you see. You know, your eyes are seeing billions of bits of information. So,
yes.
So, yes. And you try to get past these guys that are stuck in this scientism, and, you know, they can measure less than 1% of the universe in which we live, but they want you to formulate all of your stuff into that 1%, which is insane, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that's, you know, that's the realm they live in. But there are this band of other scientists, and as I say, I was very interested in finding them. When I first got involved with this, I was interested, as I mentioned at the top of the program, in trying to figure out why homeopathy works and spiritual healing works, and that really set me on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was going to be fairly simple. I would speak to a few scientists, they would talk to me about energy fields, and I'd write it up, and that would be it. But to my astonishment, I found that there were this little band of there were pockets of resistance to the Orthodox view all around the world. And that's really what I ended up writing about, was these brave, brave iconoclasts who had, and sometimes, you know, hurt their personal careers because they'd, in the course of looking at something ordinary, had come up with a square peg that didn't fit the round hole of conventional science. And nevertheless, being true scientists and true explorers, they carried on with this journey, even if it took them to a place they didn't want to go to. And in many, many cases, they just kept pursuing this line of inquiry. And it came up with extraordinary evidence about the role in consciousness mm-hmm. in creating our world, and also the role of the field, the zero-point field, in being a unified factor. I mean, one of the most amazing things, I think, that has been now postulated by people like Carl Pribram, famous neuroscientist, is that all higher function, including memory, in his view, isn't in the brain. It's kept out there in the field. And the brain is more like a transducer, antenna receiver, that picks up this material and then transfers it for information for the rest of the body. But that information is held not inside the skull, but in the field.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the genome experiment, they were expecting to find, what, something like 100,000 genes plus, and they only mm-hmm. found 30. And they came to the conclusion that there was some outside field or intelligence that's actually making the body function. It's not just a biological, you know, event that's going on. I know Bruce Lipton did a lot of work in that field, and so basically, right there, they're stuck. I mean, the mainstream scientists are stuck. They can only go so far, and now they have to get into quantum physics or consciousness or something outside the physical.
Well, this is the thing. I think that Bruce, as is one of the wonderful people who is, you know, doing epigenetics, where he's demonstrated that it's the outside the cell that is really what is determining the cell's activity, not the set within the cell. And that is just remarkable and revolutionary.
Yeah,
and it's one of the things demonstrating that our environment, that we are, you know, we are interacting and a function of our environment,
yeah,
and not this little isolated being.
Exactly.
And that, I think, is what everybody's also saying, in a way, one after another, in their different ways, with their different studies, which is that we are all connected,
uh-huh.
and we're connected, and we are all able to access so much more information than we think.
You know, going into that line of what you just said, what I find it very interesting is with me, I've studied pretty much all the different religions, and I just see they have different words for all ending up in the same place, and different languages and different techniques. But the unified field and all these other new breakthroughs in quantum physics are unifying people and bringing people together and saying, hey, look, we all live in this unified field of consciousness. We're one people on one planet. You know, and it's all interconnected, and we have to get rid of these religious, or transcend all these religious and governmental boundaries and all these other things that we're working with right now, because in truth, we really are one. Like, everything is tied together, and we need to start functioning.
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. Well, I think, and this is this really has huge implications. This is another thing that I've written about in the field, which is, it's been something I've been thinking about since I published the book, which is that if we are all connected, if a unified field connects us, and if we have all of this extended human potential, then our human potential, as we understand it, is just a glimmer of what it could be. If we're all one and not separate beings on a separate planet, in a, you know, lonely beings on a lonely planet in a lonely universe, then we have to rethink the whole thing. We have to rethink and learn another way to be. We have to look at our societal structures, because in a way they are all based on the current scientific view. I mean, this is the problem with science. We think of science as this ultimate truth, but actually it's just a story told in installments. And we're just on one chapter, and pretty soon another chapter will come along to supersede this one. But the chapter we know at the moment is a Newtonian chapter about how we're all separate beings and separate and kind of finalized assemblages.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the new evidence is demonstrating that we're all a lot more mutable than we thought, and we're all influenceable and influencing all the time. So if all these things are the case, think about our societal structures. You know, our educational model is based on idealizing the individual and promoting competition. Our business model is also based on competition and individual companies and individual achievement and dog eat dog. We're told in virtually every area of our lives, whether it's setting up our homes, etc., we're looked at with competition. We're told we think about the, you know, scarcity. We talk about, you know, zero-sum game and dog eat dog and eat or be eaten. That's our whole societal overview. And what we're really saying is, no, we're all connected. And actually, the model should not be competition, but cooperation. And so it means we have to really relook at everything and start revamping from the ground up.
Now, I have a feeling that I know eventually we're going to have to go that way. The civilization is unsustainable the way it is now. And and I know nature is going to have her role coming up, too, because, you know, she just can't keep taking this program of us believing we're separate from nature as well and what we're doing to her. But
well, that's it. There's so much more evidence demonstrating that we're communicating with nature, that there is, as Baxter put it, a primary perception with nature, that, you know, there is a consciousness, and that, you know, similar to the native cultures, we have to understand that the earth isn't there just for us to plunder it and to dominate it, but that we're not the apex of being, you know, that we're just one energy in a whole system of energy. You know, we are buffeted. We're affected. I was very, very interested to see this. There's so much evidence to show that the activity of the sun, solar flares, coronal mass ejections, all of that gaseous stuff being thrown toward Earth affects us on a profound level. It hits our geomagnetic shield of the Earth, which surrounds the Earth like a donut, and then it has a profound effect on the two major engines of the body, the heart and the brain. Moreover, it has a huge effect on our psychic ability, our ability to tap into the field, and our ability to send intention. So that suggests to me that we're not the dominant force here. We're just one energy in a whole larger energetic system, and that we just have to take our place as one in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people need to go stand in front of a big wave and just say stop and just see how important they are, you know.
That's a nice way of putting it. That's a great way of putting it.
That was my humbling experience. That's where I had the near-death experience. I got caught in these sneaker waves, and they're 17 to 25 feet tall, and nature very much humbled me there.
Oh, my goodness.
On that
wow. Experience. Where was this?
It was in Little Corona, right next to the Wedge, down in California. I was out body surfing, and I was captain of the water polo team and swim team, and I thought I was bulletproof out in the water, and had a major wake-up call there. But
boy, I bet. My goodness.
Yeah,
and how long were you under for?
You know, I have no idea, because I was way out on a sandbar, and the last memory was, you know, going through the tunnel like everybody talks about. And then,
wow.
And then, I don't know, a lot of time elapsed, and then later on they're pulling me in, you know, off the seat. Somebody pulled me in, and I was...
Wow.
Pretty much
unconscious. Did you have the situation where you were told to go back or anything like that? Did you meet any...
Yeah, I did.
Did you go into the light and meet beings and things?
You know what?
Relative?
I went through this tunnel, and it just kept going and going and going, and I ended up in this golden plane of bliss. It was golden white light, and there was a consciousness that was surrounding me, and I was part of that consciousness, but there was a greater consciousness there as well. You're unique yet one in that experience. And I had a conversation with it, and what I realized is I bypassed all the other stopping points and went straight, you know, to the source, you might say.
To the light, right.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And it was quite an amazing event, and then I came back you know, to help people wake up to the fact that, you know, there isn't this little old man out there with a beard with a computer, you know, keeping tabs on everybody and punishing this person and that person. You know, it's really our own consciousness that's creating those realities.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, we'll have to talk.
It's incredible, these experiences, and it's. I mean, I was very interested to look at the data about this. I've had on one of our conferences. My company runs a lot of conferences and workshops on living the field and taking this into your life. And one of our conferences featured, with many other scientists, a Pim van Lommel, who has been a Dutch cardiologist who's been studying near-death experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And he got very interested because a lot of his cardiac patients who were out for a while and clinically dead for a bit would return and be resuscitated and experience this similar path and the similar procession of things happening. So it's completely changed his view, and he's published some data about it. And they were quite extraordinary studies, too. They were particularly interesting for people's ability to recollect exactly when it went on, when they were clinically dead. So it really destroys the model we have of, you know, the brain is the central computer, because here's a situation where the computer is unplugged,
uh-huh.
and nevertheless, the person has complete consciousness during the event and afterward remembers. For instance, there was one guy who came in, he was in a car accident, he was dead, this is a Dutch guy, an older man, and he was brought in the emergency room, and they have what's called a crash cart, where they take your clothes and throw all that stuff over on this cart when they rush to get you into the hospital gear and resuscitate you. And all of this happened, and he had false teeth, which were, you know, quite mangled. So they took them out and they put them on this crash cart. And afterward, when he revived and he came back from being basically pronounced dead, he said, could you ask that nice, pretty young nurse where my false teeth are? I know she's got it on that cart. Now, all of that occurred when the guy was clinically dead. So, again, that is such interesting element about the role of consciousness, that consciousness is not connected to the activity of the brain, but is something other, larger, and doesn't die.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've had my own experiences in that level of going out of body. I actually have pictures of me going out of body, and you can see one body sitting in meditation, and the other body leaving, coming up out of the body. And I did it with Tom Dongo, who's a professional photographer. And I said, okay, I'll tell you when I'm leaving. And I said, okay, now. And he shot it with regular emulsion film. And you can see, it's on my website in my bio, you can see myself coming out of the body. But after the near-death experience, I seemed to be able to go and experience all those other planes and dimensions. And without a doubt, now I know we're multidimensional beings existing on this vibrational continuum, but we're hoodwinked into thinking that we're just a body and a personality, and we're just here to compete and react to the world around us, and that's something we have to transcend.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's really interesting is this, all of the questions it raises. I mean, certainly for Pim van Lommel, seeing this kind of thing convinced him that consciousness doesn't die, and that in a sense maybe we just return to the field, or we become more, you know, we decouple from the body and the consciousness carries on. But it's very, you know, it raises so many questions. And once again, to say very dumb and limited things about the brain, the consciousness only being available in the brain, really goes against the current science as well as anything else.
Uh-huh. You know, it really does. If people would just do the research and really look into it, it's obvious there that, you know, going back to the solar, we're going into the solar cycle 24, which is supposed to be the incredible energy influx. And I noticed that in Stanford they did research with monkeys, and they subjected them to fluctuations in the magnetic field. And they exhibited behavior, everything from comatose to self-mutilation. It was pretty insane. And I know
they demonstrate that real effect of different, you know, of magnetic fields. Again, that we are part of an energetic system, and when we get energetically out of whack, then it really affects us. Yes. You know, I'm really interested when you talked about having out-of-body experiences after this near-death experience, because I think what's interesting about near-death experiences, it's almost like you permanently touch the hem of the field, because there are so many people I know who have had NDRs and come back with enhanced psychic ability. And that sounds like you did too, that you access this and you have a, as you call it, an interdimensional mind. And you have this ability to now just rise above the body and probably what had happened. And I think that this is, you know, this is very interesting. It's like you all are messengers.
Yeah. What's interesting about what's sad, people go, well, you know, they want proof. And I said, well, give me an interdimensional camera, you know, give me a beaker that I can take with me and fill up with something, you know, on for, you know, non-physical and bring it back. It's, you know,
sure.
You can't really do it, you know. And so what I tell people is, look, we can teach you how to have the same experience. We can teach you how to do it yourself. But the bottom line is people need to really make their own personal connection with spirit and do their own research and, you know, read these awesome books like you've written, you know, The Intention Experiment in the Field. And just,
well, I think that, you know, people have to understand that they can move beyond the kind of limiting beliefs that a lot of the scientific fundamentalists say by looking at the other science that's out there. I think that's what people look to me for, which is that I've tried to champion science because, you know, people say, oh, there's no proof for this. Well, both of my books, while I've written them for just a lay audience and they're just for just general public, they are based on about 50 pages of notes and bibliography. There's just a huge amount of research in each of them
mm-hmm.
in this field. And that's the thing I think people are so surprised about is, wow, I didn't think they, you know, that we had the proof. And I guess it's my job, really has been my job, to popularize this, make it understandable to people. And also, and that's why, because I'm not a scientist, I come from that place of being a nonfiction writer rather than a scientist. But also to demonstrate that there is a thread. I mean, one of the difficulties I had when I was first researching is that scientists, first of all, talk in code. And so you have to decode what they're saying, and that can be a pretty tough process. And secondly, they deal with just their little experimental discovery and not look at the big picture and how this all fits in with everything else. So I guess that's been my task, too, is really to put this into a whole framework to show people there is a whole new reality here. There's a new science. There's a new view of the world. And here we are, a new dimension.
Now, how does one get in contact with you and get your books? Could you give us the websites over the air here?
Sure. For participating in the intention experiments, people can just come on to www.theintentionexperiment.com, and they can also get our weekly e-news, which talks about all the intention experiments and new information about intention, and it's me writing it, too. And then I have another website called livingthefield.com. That's www.livingthefield.com. And that is a more expansive website about bringing these new ideas into your daily life. And that's what I do my seminars and workshops on now, and what I've done a whole course on this, because people are very interested in, you know, once they've read The Field, they say, okay, I get this, and I want to live this. I want to live a new kind of life of unity. But how do I do this? And so when I first published the book in 2002, that was my real question. I said, okay, how do you? And so I've spent 4 or 5 years with a team of people studying native traditions and the way animals behave, you know, because animals live in the field, and plants and other dimensions and the latest science and a philosophy and just about and all kinds of extrasensory practice and programs in order to show people in a sort of methodical way how to bring this into their life. So that's really what Living the Field is, seminars and also a written course. So if people want more information and also a community of people who are practicing it, that's what they can get from Living the Field, too. So we welcome people coming to both sites.
And we'd also welcome people joining into our intention experiments. It's, you know, you just log on and find out the date of the next experiment and send some thoughts, as we'll tell you exactly what to do, at a certain particular time to a certain target. We've got some really exciting ones coming up. We've got the, we're going to be working on the polluted water one. We're going to be, at another time, we've got an intention experiment to raise the grade point average in one of the poorest parts of America, which I think the lowest grade point average is Cleveland, Ohio. So we're going to work on that. We've talked about doing ones that will lower violence in a particular hot spot in the world. And we've got a little ecosphere that we're working on now, a little mini Gaia, where we're going to try to lower the temperature there. We're going to be doing that with the University of Arizona. And that will, of course, have enormous implications for global warming.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah, we could definitely do all kinds of fun experiments. Let me know if you're ever in the States here, because we have conferences here, and we have a big conference building, and we bring people out here. And I think you would love it out here, because this place is like Paranormal Central. It's a vortex, and talk about fields.
I mean, what part of California is it?
Actually, I'm in Washington. I'm right at the base of Mount Adams in Trout Lake,
Washington.
Oh, lovely. Right next to the Yakima Nation. And this area, there is so much weirdness going on here. It's like UFO, Paranormal Central. You know, we've got everything from Bigfoot to other things going on. It's one of the major UFO hotspots on the planet.
Wonderful. Well, I think we'll be in Seattle at some point next year. We're going to be doing a seminar there. So I'd love to come and see you sometime. That would be great.
Yeah, maybe we can set one up here. We'll set up a gathering here at the same time. And then
that would be wonderful.
I think you'd have a lot of fun here.
Sounds like it. Well, it sounds like I have a lot of interesting audiences, people in the audience of different dimensions.
Yeah. Well, I had a physicist here, and he came up here, and he's very, you know, left brain, really wants all of his instruments and everything. And he was standing out looking at the mountain. This beam of light came out and hit him in the chest and changed his whole life. And he said, I don't use my body for analyzing, you know, information or holding information. I use instruments. And
wow.
Brooks Agnew is his name. You can ask him about it. But it was quite interesting. It totally changed his life.
I bet. Boy, that sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, he had a major exchange there that was life-changing. It took him, even when he talks about it, now he gets tears. He can hardly even talk about it because
that's incredible. That sounds really interesting. Well, it sounds like it would be really fun to come see you and speak there.
Yeah, I'm not sure what our timeline is because I don't even know when we started because our I think we started a little late, so we've got a little more time, I believe.
Sure. Well, we've got. Go ahead.
We've got about 1 minute. So let's give your website one more time.
Okay, it's the two websites are www.theintentionexperiment.com, and for Living the Field, for bringing this into your life, it's www.livingthefield.com.
Great. Well, you know, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's been an awesome interview, and we'll be letting you know when we're going to air it, and we'll put up your websites and everything on the show. So,
that's wonderful. It's been a real pleasure, James.
Yeah, we'll do it again soon.
Great. I'd like to do that.
Great.
Take care.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Great. Well, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, signing off. Have a great evening. Good night.